Today, working with Ebola in Liberia. My guest is Lisa Belcher. She's a research scientist with the CDC, also a friend. She is just back from a month in Liberia, where she was working for the CDC, doing what the CDC does. Lisa Belcher, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, you're past the 21 days, so you're not wearing a mask.
That's right. That's right.
Everybody, I'm fine. No worries. But tell me, you've worked with HIV. That's been your primary job at the CDC for a long time.
Right.
How come you ended up going to Liberia?
Well, and there are a lot of people who work in various areas of the CDC right now who are getting called up to work on this, on the Ebola response. Some of them are working here in Atlanta at the Emergency Operations Center, and some, many fewer, are going to the countries that are most affected. And
What won you that honor?
Well, I volunteered. So some people are going because they get deployed and they're part of the U.S. Public Health Service, which I am. But I also volunteered before I was deployed because I was ready to go and sort of serve over there and do see if I could help.
You thought you'd be doing one thing, but
right.
You ended up doing something
else.
That's right.
I volunteered thinking that I would go and be a part of basically a panel that reviews funding proposals for emergency funding for things that are meant to help the epidemic in an emergency situation.
Give me an example.
So if there was a need for a clinic to be set up or, you know, food for a quarantine or something like that, basically local communities were sending in funding proposals or NGOs sending in funding proposals to this panel, which is called the DART. And it operates in emergency situations and they make decisions about whether this is already being funded or whether it's a good use of funds, an efficient use of funds. And then they can get money to those programs very quickly, unlike the typical government situation where it takes a while.
Well, that sounds, you know, if I was being deployed, of course, you know, way too chicken to even think about that kind of thing. But if I was being deployed, I'd think, okay, reviewing funding proposals, I'll be in a nice office, get to go to the hotel at night.
Exactly.
Not a problem, won't be around anyone who's sick. Well, how long did that last?
I arrived on Sunday night and went to work on Monday morning, and we were briefed, and I was told fairly quickly that I'd be going out into the field rather than working at the embassy. So it didn't last long.
Okay, so what were you actually doing?
So for the first few days, I was in Monrovia, which is the capital city, and I was essentially preparing to deploy to the field. So about half of the cases in Liberia are in Monrovia and in the capital city. The rest of the cases are spread across the counties pretty evenly, actually, in very rural areas. And I was deployed to a county called Grand Cape Mount, which is about a two-hour drive from Monrovia. And so we went out on Thanksgiving Day, and we stayed in a guest house that was just about 100 yards from an Ebola treatment unit. We were stationed there, and then every day we would essentially go out and respond to cases and to case investigation, and then we would go around to find out who sort of had contact with the case, whether it was a dead body, someone that had died, you know, the night before, or whether it was someone who was very ill, and we would get a report and go out and find out who had contact with that person.
The goal being, in a classic public health sense, to figure out who has it and then who's been in contact with that person and then also might then be a carrier of the disease.
Exactly. So we're tracking it for surveillance purposes, and then we would put anyone who had contact with that case on a 21-day quarantine, which meant essentially that they needed to stay in their home and not have contact with anyone else who wasn't in their residence. And so, and we would go back and follow up to make sure that was happening. And then other jobs that we needed to follow up on was we needed to make sure that they got food because, you know, the people that live in these villages are typically
subsistence farmers.
Exactly, farmers and taking care of their own needs. And if they can't get out into the fields and create their own food, then they are reliant on us to get it for them. So the World Food Program was helping with that.
So, you know, you're a scientist. You've been working with HIV, an infectious disease, but one that we know very clearly and have for a very long time how that disease is transmitted. This one is, you know, much more mysterious and much more, just strikes me at least, from attempting to think of myself being in your shoes, as being a much more terrifying thing to deal with. How do you do that? What was your process of getting into that car every day and going off into the field? How do you do that?
Well, when I arrived in Liberia, I was actually kind of nervous and scared. And I think probably most people that first arrive in the country, and we had seen a lot of reports about Ebola and the spread and how quickly it was spreading and how infectious it was. And I don't work in that field. And so I had about the same level of knowledge, probably a little bit more insider knowledge working at CDC, but as the average person walking around. So we were briefed in detail, especially when we got there, about what to expect. We were certainly monitored a lot. They took our temperature, you know, 10 or 15 times a day at road stops and wherever we were, and washing hands and that sort of thing. So there were lots of precautions. We were very much encouraged and told seriously to let them know, let everyone and anyone know if we weren't feeling well. And all of those things, for me in the beginning, caused more anxiety than anything, because it just made it seem like it was so highly infectious and that I really needed to be concerned. I think that I was there for a month, and if you kind of had an anxiety reading for me on day one or two versus day 29, it was radically different. I think I had a much better understanding from working with people who were living in the households of people who were very sick, and that they were not getting infected. Unless you really had close contact with someone who was extremely ill in sort of the end stages of life, and you had a lot of contact with them.
Well, let's be specific. I mean, this disease, at the end stages of life, it's diarrhea.
That's
it's
right.
Blood. It's fluids coming out of the body. And,
exactly.
And to contract the disease, you have to have those things touch your skin, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the things that you would have contact with if you were a caretaker, which is the reason we saw those infections here in the United States. Right. And in those cases, it actually happens. You know, it is extremely infectious, and you can expect that, in fact, people will be infected in those cases. But it's not common for just everyone to have contact with someone who's that extremely ill, especially
right
now. And then obviously many, many of the cases in Liberia were occurring after death, because
culturally, how the body is prepared for burial.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And so that was actually more of an issue, I think, than even caretaking was. It took a little while for those practices to be let go of. And in some cases, they haven't yet been. There's still some secret burials and rituals that are going on that are really putting people at risks, and some of these transmission chains are continuing because of the burial practices. But it's certainly gotten a lot better since
September. Were you wearing the moon suit that you see, or did, how often were you in that situation, if at all?
Never. We were given PPE, protective gear,
personal
to wear.
Personal protection gear, right.
Yeah. And when we went, before we left, so everyone deploys with that, and we're also told when they give it to us. So that's gloves and a gown. It's not the suits that you see on the news, but it's more what you might see in sort of a surgeon wearing or something, and a mask. And then we were told, if you're ever wearing these, essentially you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. You should never really be in a situation. CDC employees are not giving patient
care. Right.
Yeah. Except for a very few who are working in a hospital. Those are the U.S. Public Health Service employees and staff, and they're taking care of healthcare workers. But the vast majority of us should not have been anywhere near someone who we needed to be wearing protective gear around. So, so no, I never wore gloves. I never wore a gown or a mask. I was doing interviews with people who, in the end, I did learn had Ebola, and some of them died, but none of them were sick. None of them were when I was speaking to them. There's a no touch policy in all of these countries. It's probably, there's a little complacency now because the case count is down so radically since when it started. But really, the culture there is, you know, don't touch. You just don't do it anymore. And it's very difficult, I think, for Liberians, because they're very affectionate people, very friendly, and they like to hug and. There's a
right.
There are touching sort
yeah.
of culture, and so it's been difficult for I think that to really take hold, but that's the rule.
Tell me about the first time you stepped into someone's home to talk to them. What was that first?
So really the way that it worked, we didn't go into homes. We would come into a community, and because essentially everyone was staying in their village, we would drive in a very noticeable, so these are very rural sort of small villages, and so we were noticeable in a big white all-terrain sort of SUV, and the people in the village would see us arrive. We would go to what they call the Palava Hut usually and see if we could speak to the town chief, and that was fairly easy to do, or an imam or someone. And then they would essentially call a meeting of whoever we needed to speak to, whether it was the entire village or whether it was a particular person, to sort of find out about what their symptoms were or whatever. We generally stayed in that Palava hut, which is the meeting place in all of these villages. And they all have one. Almost no matter how remote they are, they all have a meeting place. And that's where we did most of the work. Every now and then we would walk around a village and check on the outside of huts and residences, but that was pretty rare.
And were you going back to Monrovia and sleeping at your hotel every night, or were you sleeping out in the field? Or
yeah, so when I went out on Thanksgiving, I was out for 9 days. We stayed in a little town called Sinje, which is, I don't know how many people live there, but it's small. And we stayed in, I was there with two other epidemiologists from the CDC. And we stayed in what is essentially a concrete building. There's no plumbing, no electricity anywhere. And so it wasn't camping. It wasn't tent camping. We had shelter, and I was glad for that on the nights when it really poured down rain. But it was tough. We would go back into the city, into Monrovia, for a couple of days and a shower and some food, usually on a couple of days on the weekends after that.
The Mamba Bay, was that the name of your hotel?
A Mamba Point Hotel.
Mamba Point
Hotel. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a very luxurious place when you've been field.
Yeah. Wow, that must be something when you're covering something like Ebola and worried about fluids and, you know, you don't have access to plumbing and having to go to the bathroom out and whatever. That can't have been a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, it kind of worked on your mind a little bit sometimes. And also, you know, one thing I really recall is how often I felt nauseous while I was there. And some of it really had to do with the smells, but also it had to do with the fact that we were, you know, riding on these terrible roads and for 3 or 4 hour trips out to a village. And I was usually in the backseat feeling really car sick. So by the time I got there, I was sometimes having to sort of hang out in the car for a minute so that I wasn't the one who was
barfing, getting
sick in front of people and we were telling what the symptoms were.
Yeah. That would not have been good. What was the hardest part for you?
I think it was the children that I eventually kind of came to learn when I would be with a group of children and a family after two or three sort of rounds of doing visits to communities and understanding how the contact tracing worked. You know, I would begin to realize that I was looking at a group of people, and many of them were under 10, and some of them were going to die, and they didn't know it, and some of them had already lost their parents or their grandparents. So there had already been a pretty serious tragedy in the very recent past for them, and I was beginning to realize, and that became the hardest part, is I would look at this group of kids and know that some of them were going to die, and they were going to die very quickly, and it's not an easy death. And it still is sort of a very challenging thing. I still hear about, because I haven't been back that long, I still hear about cases of children that I very clearly recall interacting with and who didn't make it. And it's really terribly sad because, well, it's, you know, it's just it's a sad situation that they're in. But Liberians have a very genuine way and a very loving approach, and they smile and connect very quickly once you smile at them and once you connect with them. And it was, they were an easy people to love and to get connected with so quickly. And the children in particular just so much wanted to interact with us. And so it was striking how difficult that part of it was. It's very sad.
What goes through your head when you're sitting there with a bunch of kids and you know 25% of them or whatever are going to die, and they don't, at this point, presumably have even any symptoms?
Well, anxiety, and, you know, we would, you know, take the temperatures and that sort of thing. And of course, at first, when they wouldn't have a fever, I would feel, oh, they're going to be okay. And in the end, I learned that that wasn't always an indicator that they were going to be okay. Sometimes it was, but it wasn't fail safe. And, you know, I wasn't there long enough to really get to really appreciate sort of what differentiated who was going to get sick and who wasn't. And I think that's still difficult to do. But it's just an anxiety provoking sort of situation. I can remember sort of pacing back and forth at one household where these six kids had been all exposed to their parents who had both died in the week before, and we were taking all of them to the ETU as cases and just really struggling with what was going to happen and what was the plight of these six kids. And that family only one of those six died. And so that, you know, there are some stories that I can walk away with that I know as a result of the interventions that were taking place, lives were saved. And that's exactly what's curbing the epidemic right now.
What is the status of the epidemic now? I mean, the you know, it's faded from the front pages, but that means nothing, I know. What is the status?
Well, it means something, and I'm not up to date with specifics on the numbers and the trends sort of on a weekly basis. I know that Liberia was in terrible shape in September, August and September. Things started, I think, to get better beginning in October, meaning they were, say, 100 cases or more a week in the late summer. And by the time I was there, we were getting close to under 10 cases a week, and now I think it's probably 6 or 7. So the expectation there, and they've reopened schools. The schools there had been closed for almost a year. So wow. They're reopening the schools, I think, on February the 2nd, wow. Which is huge, huge for this country, yeah. Because it's just, and hospitals as well, they've basically turned, you know, all of the medical care became about Ebola. There was really no access to other medical care for any other cause. So I think that they can start to get back to normal. On the other hand, Sierra Leone is sort of where Liberia was in September. And so they're struggling. I'm not sure. I think that they maybe have turned down the case counts in the past couple of weeks, but they're still kind of in the thick of things there in Sierra Leone. And I know that Guinea is in a similar situation. So it's certainly by no means over, but I think that there are definitely reasons to have hope that it will not become as devastating as initially the estimates that the CDC published had been. So that's really quite a relief.
So when you left, was it a relief or did you have mixed feelings or...
Yeah, I did have mixed feelings. It was I left on December the 19th, got back to Atlanta on the 20th, and I love to be at home for the holidays, and so I was very happy to be getting home to my family. I missed my family and my dogs, but I also was leaving at the time where there were 4 new hotspots that had sort of emerged in the days right before I left in the county that I was working in. And 19 of us left on the 19th, including Dr. Frieden, who had been there for a visit.
That's the head of the CDC.
That's right. Yeah, the director. And so I did feel a little bit like I was kind of abandoning ship. And I think everybody kind of goes through that feeling. They really need all the help that they can get. And certainly people who go and get trained up and learn the systems and the culture are encouraged to come back.
Reentry in the U.S., what happened when you checked in at customs or whatever?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think for me, I was the only one on the flight. I didn't come back with, for whatever reason, we all had different flight itineraries, and I was the only person coming back from Monrovia on the flight that I arrived on in Atlanta. And I say unfortunately because when I got there, you know, they go through the procedure of, which is their protocol, and the, you know, the customs person puts on a mask and gave me a mask and I had an escort over to the area where they took my temperature and interview. But all
which
of this
makes everyone standing behind you feel really
right,
good.
All of this happens with the 300 people or so that you were on the plane with their jaws dropped and eyes wide open wondering,
you're feeling,
you know,
like Typhoid Mary. Yeah.
Right, right. So that part was a little weird, but I think, and I was the only person on the plane. I think if there had been a group of us, then it would have been more obvious that we were from CDC or something. But, you know, I wanted to just reassure the people, I'm really okay, no problem. But yeah, so that was.
I mean,
was,
what did was the customs guy afraid? Did his eyes get big? Or,
yeah, you yeah. Know, I mean, his eyes did get big, and he may not have been terribly afraid, but he certainly responded sort of, he backed up and I was very much treated as if I was someone to be afraid of for a few minutes until they took my temperature. And I think they were more calm about, you know, what my status was.
What about family and, you know, friends? I mean, how did people react to you? Were some people afraid or?
They may have been. If they were, they didn't tell me. I had certainly heard stories from other colleagues, that people had pretty directly said, you know, I'm worried about being around you. I did have a neighbor sort of joke with me, you know, where are you in your 21 days? And we'll see you then. And I wasn't sure if she was being serious or not. But really, for the most part, my family was great. No one really acted differently around me. And I think everyone around me that's close to me sort of made an effort to kind of give me a hug or show me in some way that they felt comfortable around me, which was nice. And there is a sort of a stigmatizing effect and a distancing sure. effect from having been there.
The scene in the Hurt Locker where the bomb disposal guy comes back and then you see him going through the supermarket and being overwhelmed by America. I'm wondering if you had any sort of reentry stuff, which is after having slept on concrete floors with no plumbing and seeing kids who you knew were going to die, what it was like to sort of step back into our comfortable American Atlanta lives.
Yeah. I think you pointed out to me when we talked about it when I first came back. I also came back sort of at the time of the most glitter and lights around the
December
holidays
19th, 20th,
and exactly there was a lot going on and it was sort of a culture shock. I love the holidays and I was happy to be here and hearing the sounds and sights, seeing the sights, but I was exhausted and it was a little challenging. And I can't say that it entirely goes away. It may go away, but it hasn't as of yet. And I've been back for a month, I think.
What happens? What strikes you? Do you have flashbacks to faces? Or, I mean, what sets off when you say it hasn't gone away? Just what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think what really is just that you really begin to understand this difference in the way that we live and the way that other people in the world are living and the comforts that we have that I certainly appreciate. But for some reason, really put me in touch with, and I got some clarity on a real desire to sort of want to simplify and I don't know, take it down a notch or two in terms of the things that I have and the comforts that I have, because I just feel like, you know, there could be no end to how many comforts you can have, but the happiness that I saw when I was there, and I've worked in Africa before, and I've always been struck by the children and how happy they seem, even in the worst slums in Nairobi or wherever. It's remarkable to me that the smiles and the genuine joy that the kids have, and really that most people that you see have, and they aren't hung up on the typical anxieties that we have, the aspirations and difficulties and the wants and that sort of thing. And I think it's just a simpler way of life that I appreciate. It's not as comfortable all the time, and I was glad to get back to a comfortable bed for sure. But so I haven't found the balance. But
yeah, well, no, that's the eternal challenge
yep.
of people in your profession or journalists for that matter who cover strange things and who get outside of, you know, the daily lives that most Americans lead.
Exactly.
Last question. Will you go back?
I probably will go back.
Do you want to go back?
You know, yes, I think I do. I want to go back because I can really so clearly sort of get in touch and quickly understand how what kind of an impact, really, you know, sort of just basic skills, basic survival skills allow you to have, you know, on what's going on there. The hardest part about doing the work that I was doing is surviving the discomfort of it. Because really, after that, it's not rocket science. You don't have to be some specialist in epidemiology to do what we were doing. But the impact that you can have is pretty remarkable. And it's sort of like you think about saving lives like you would or I would think about it as a physician would something like that.
ER or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's very appealing.
And you're saving lives with a pencil and paper.
Yeah.
And making suggestions for behavioral change.
Exactly.
Basically.
Yeah. And also helping people get food and some basic needs met and things that really just fill some gaps that need to be filled. And that is a very rewarding work. And I, you know, the work that I do on a daily basis it's not as directly rewarding. It's a part of the big machine that's working to help keep our country safe and healthy, but it's not nearly as immediately reinforcing. And so I think I'd go back for that reason. And just because it's an experience that is part of history and it's compelling to me.
I'm proud to know you.
Thanks,
Thank
David.
Thank you for doing the work
say
you
the
do.
Same. Thank
Lisa
you.
Belcher, research scientist at the CDC. Thank you. My guest is Lisa Belcher. She's a research scientist with the CDC. She's just back from a month in Liberia, where she was working on the Ebola epidemic. I'm discussing the Ebola epidemic with a research scientist from the CDC. Lisa Belcher is just back from a month in Liberia, where she was working on the epidemic. Tomorrow, we'll continue my conversation with Lisa Belcher, the research scientist from the CDC, about her experience working on the Ebola epidemic in Liberia. Today, continuing my conversation with Lisa Belcher. She is a research scientist at the CDC, and she is just back from a month in Liberia where she was working on the Ebola epidemic. Hey, folks, it's David Lewis. This morning at 8:30, I'll be talking about the Ebola epidemic with a CDC research scientist who's just back from a month in Liberia. Hey, folks, it's David Lewis. At 5:30 this afternoon, I'll be talking about the Ebola epidemic with a research scientist from the CDC who's just back from a month in Liberia. My guest is Lisa Belcher, a friend and a research scientist at the CDC. She is just back from a month in Liberia where she was working on the Ebola epidemic.